Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, is Tom Cruise's final impossible mission also a swan song for a certain kind of American fame? And the strange history and enduring political legacy of a Beach Boys song parody. But first, yesterday, New York City finalized the tally of votes in last Tuesday's primary election for mayor. The count confirmed what had been clear since election night. Democratic Socialist Zoran Mamdani decisively defeated former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo by 12 points, garnering over 500,000 votes. Mamdani will now be the Democratic nominee for mayor of the country's largest city, and the wave of attention and scrutiny over his policy positions has brought wall-to-wall coverage on cable news for the last week. His victory has also brought renewed attention to democratic socialism as a political philosophy. And so, to find out how Mamdani's win is resonating here in the Valley, I sat down with Dylan Wild, an organizer for Phoenix's chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America.
Our chapter has doubled in size since the election of Donald Trump and has experienced another huge surge in membership with all the news about Zoran's incredible victory. You know, we engage in a wide variety of activities in the Valley. We feed the unhoused. We put on social events so people can come together. We engage in electoral work where we've supported candidates like Anna Hernandez, who now sit on Phoenix City Council. We're excited and eager to jump back into the electoral ring, seeing especially that there is a clear appetite for this in the United States. And we're going to be making plans here soon.
What are people saying with this recent surge of interest? Not just, I mean, even pre-Mamdani too, as you were saying. What sorts of things, just anecdotally, are you hearing from people who are starting to come to meetings?
Yeah, I mean, people are just especially fed up with the Democratic Party. Like, more and more new members are coming, and we always ask them, like, what brought you to Phoenix DSA? And they're saying that they don't feel represented as working class people in today's Democratic Party, and that they're looking for ways to organize around issues that will tangibly impact our lives and address things like the cost of living crisis.
Do you feel like... I mean, obviously, you know, if we look at the chyrons on cable news, we are being told that Zoran Mamdani and democratic socialism in general represents the new vanguard of the Democratic Party. I hear you saying that a lot of the conversation happening within Phoenix DSA is about dissatisfaction with the Democratic Party and a desire to push things in a more democratic socialist direction.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, DSA is not a political party, but historically, DSA members have run on the Democratic Party ballot line. So as to the question of whether or not DSA is the future of the Democratic Party, I certainly hope so. But when you sit down and you examine the reactions to Zoran Mamdani, it's not just establishment Republicans that are pushing back against his victory. It's establishment corporatist Democrats as well.
So when you say DSA is not a political party, I think some people listening to this are going to go, I didn't realize that. So it sounds a little bit more like a values-driven activist group rather than a group with an explicit politics.
Well, we absolutely have an explicit politics. Right. We believe that our economy and our democracy should work for everybody and not just ruling elites and the wealthy. Things like Medicare for all, universal child health care are bedrock positions for democratic socialists. But there's absolutely a lot of room and a lot of range from one DSA chapter to the next about what we fight for, especially because our fights are so local.
What are some of the main priorities for DSA in Phoenix?
Locally, the thing that we care the most about right now is meeting the needs of the unhoused population, right? Because it's not enough to just provide services, to provide food, to provide water to unhoused people in public parks, et cetera. We need to actually fight to keep people in their homes who are on the brink of becoming homeless or unhoused. So to that end, our electoral work, the candidates that we support, the people that we want to run in the next cycle, all care very deeply about housing justice. We've called for things like a moratorium on evictions in the summertime because we know that the intense heat in Arizona can be a death sentence. We've called for increased rental assistance so that people who are on the brink have an opportunity to stay in their homes before they do become unhoused. And we've called for public defenders being allocated to anybody facing eviction who might be in a battle with their landlord in the city of Tempe.
How long have you been involved with DSA?
I've been involved in DSA since 2020, around the Bernie moment.
Okay. Can you say, just for yourself, what about Senator Sanders' campaign prompted you to get involved?
Yeah. So at that time, I was working as an educator. I taught for 7 years before I moved on to other things. And I always taught in underprivileged Title I schools, sometimes in rough neighborhoods. I tried to show up to work every day and be an excellent teacher. But at the end of the day, I realized that being excellent at teaching physics or literature or English wasn't going to be enough to transform the communities in which I was teaching. We need real political solutions that transform the possibilities that are presented to working class people so that we can climb out of poverty.
So how would you compare the energy that you felt in 2020 with the energy that you're seeing now related to Zohran Mamdani?
Great question. So around the Sanders campaign, right, in 2020, National DSA goes from being an organization of about 20,000 people to 70,000 people. We're experiencing similar energy again with the rise of Zohran Mamdani. People are reaching out to us every day saying, where's a campaign like that that I can participate in right here in Phoenix, Arizona?
What do you think, just in your own opinion, makes for an effective leader of a campaign that is driven by values that DSA would align with? Because one of the things that to me seems to be a commonality when we look at campaigns that have generated a lot of national interest and are affiliated with democratic socialism, we're thinking about Senator Sanders, obviously, thinking of Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Zohran Mamdani. These are all people who obviously share the values of the movement, but are also extremely charismatic, really effective speakers and communicators. How do you square that with the fact that DSA, if I'm hearing you correctly, is a movement largely driven by collective action, but does seem to need a leader who has an ability to kind of take up the mantle, even if it's not necessarily about them as an individual?
Great question. So the national figures that you just talked about, like Rashida Tlaib, AOC, Bernie Sanders, Zohran Mamdani, the thing that is clear to me is that these are all working class people and a lot of diversity. I think DSA members can see ourselves and all of these people to varying degrees. What it takes to be a powerful DSA candidate is to stand strongly on working class values, to demonstrate to people that you're not some corporate elite, you're not some rich individual who's bought their way into politics, but just like most of us, you're a person who's concerned about what's happening in their community and wanting to make a difference.
There's a lot of people, as I know you know, who are a little scared when they hear the phrase democratic socialism. What is your reply when somebody expresses anxiety, uncertainty, uneasiness, particularly if you're dealing with somebody who is notionally a progressive person, but is unwilling to affiliate themselves with those specific words or labels?
Yeah, I would say look at the issues, right? National DSA and local chapters all across the country are in lockstep with majorities of the American people on what we're fighting for. Take Medicare for All, for example. Poll after poll has demonstrated that 60% plus of Americans want to see universal health care implemented in the United States. But our politicians, time and time again, have failed to take it seriously. We believe that most Americans actually are strongly supportive of DSA's mission.
But it does seem to be that the words democratic socialism are where people get nervous. How do you navigate that? Is that something you have to talk to people about directly?
What I would say is that when Donald Trump is talking about socialism, he's not talking about socialism as we understand it. He's talking about authoritarianism. DSA is not an authoritarian organization. If we want to see our policies reflected in government, then we need to persuade majorities of Americans that these policies are worth having and then win those victories at the ballot box. We're not a revolutionary organization.
Well, Dylan Wild is an organizer with Phoenix Democratic Socialists of America. Dylan, thank you for this conversation.
Great to be here, Sam.
Phoenix last year went nearly 4 straight months without seeing high temperatures drop into the double digits. Things were not that much more comfortable in the fall, either. So we're asking some questions about this, including the role of shade in making the region cooler. There are a number of ways to provide shade, from planting trees to planning buildings and other structures. And we're talking about all this as part of an ongoing series that we're calling Throwing Shade. Today, trees are the topic of conversation, specifically the debate over how much water is too much water to use in an effort to keep old trees alive. Lawmakers in Nevada this year debated a bill that would have authorized the legislature to evaluate and review excessive water use fees and other water conservation efforts that impact turf and tree canopy. Despite winning the unanimous approval of one chamber, the measure ran up against a legislative deadline and will not be moving forward. The Southern Nevada Water Authority argued these kinds of fees are necessary and have saved a lot of water in and around Las Vegas. Jennifer Solis is a reporter for the Nevada Current and has written about this. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, and they started with the current policy in Nevada in terms of homeowners who use more water and the fact that they, right now, have to pay more.
About 2 years ago, the Las Vegas Valley Water District implemented a new water rate structure that basically imposes higher fees on the valley's biggest residential water users, and that's strictly confined to Clark County, which is a county that's been in drought for 2 decades.
And what was the thinking behind doing that? Like, was the goal to try to bring down the amount of water being used?
Yeah, so at some point, the Southern Nevada Water Authority figured out that Las Vegas is going to have to lower its water usage per household in order to keep growing. So the thought when implementing these higher fees for bigger residential water users was that we could bring the rate of water use down to a level that would allow Las Vegas to continue growing despite it's 2 decades of drought.
I mean, Las Vegas continues to grow. I would imagine it's safe to say, but has the rate of water use gone down?
Yes, the new water rate levies were really successful at getting these larger residential water users to bring down their water consumption. It was only supposed to affect the top 10% of excessive water users, but it's actually only impacted about 6% because so many people have decided that they don't want to pay those heavier fees and have themselves chosen to lower their water use. Of course, it's because it's costing them a lot more than it used to.
Yeah. Well, so then given that, why was there an effort in the Nevada legislature this year to at least start to rethink that or maybe undo it?
Yeah, so there has been a lot of controversy actually around this excessive water use levies, not for the majority of people in the valley, but for those higher water users that have been forced to pay these excessive water use fees or let their mature trees and yards die from lack of water. So there's been a lot of pushback since its implementation to get it reversed so people don't have to pay these higher fees, because it really is hitting people's pockets.
Well, it sounds like based on your reporting, it's also hurting their landscaping and, you know, mature, as you mentioned, you know, mature trees and landscapes, like trees that provide shade and maybe bring the temperature down a little bit.
Definitely. In Las Vegas, the temperature gets to such a high rate that a lot of trees can't withstand it without the water that they need to survive. So the new rate fees have caused people to stop watering their lawns and trees, which have caused a lot of mature landscaping to die. So older neighborhoods in Las Vegas that were built before there was even that drought in Las Vegas have these really large lots, you know, with lots of grass, mature trees, oaks, stuff that doesn't necessarily survive very well in the desert, especially in drought. So when people were forced to lower their water consumption, they were also forced to sort of let their mature landscaping, their trees, grass, wither away, which has been really controversial for many neighborhoods. Because in a lot of these older Las Vegas neighborhoods where these mature trees and landscapings are located, they don't necessarily have parks. So they don't necessarily have other landscaping that helps bring down the temperature. There's plenty of studies that show that trees and grass do lower the air temperature in areas nearby. And these neighborhoods that are older and lack parks and other public infrastructure that helps cool down the air with trees and grass kind of depend on these trees and grass that are in these private lots.
What are environmentalists, what are policymakers saying about what seems like a real environmental catch-22 here, right? Like, you want to conserve water and use less of it, but by doing so, you're potentially stopping doing something that can help make things cooler. Like, you have seemingly two competing environmental goals here.
It really is a catch-22. In other neighborhoods, Las Vegas is focusing on planting more drought-resistant trees and more drought-resistant landscaping that still does some things to lower the air temperature, but not the same as these larger water-intensive oak trees and lawns, right? So there is a real balance here between maintaining canopy and turf and doing everything we can to conserve water, because we are a city that depends largely on the Colorado River, which is dwindling because of overall drought in the West.
Well, so even though this effort isn't going to move forward this year, would you say that it's safe to say that this will continue to be a topic of discussion in Nevada going forward?
This will definitely continue to be a topic of discussion moving forward, even in other states. You know, other states are considering similar propositions to this one in Southern Nevada that has these excessive use fees. And in other states, you know, people are pushing back because they have some idea of what it would mean, seeing how it's been implemented in Nevada.
All right. That is Jennifer Solis, a journalist with Nevada Current. Jennifer, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, why are so many Valley restaurants closing? We'll hear from a local chef about the challenges of keeping fine dining afloat. But first, there's a lot going on, you may have noticed. It can be easy to forget, but it was just about a week ago that it seemed like the U.S. was on the precipice of war with Iran. After several days of Iran trading attacks with Israel, the U.S. entered the conflict by dropping bombs on Iranian nuclear weapons sites. Shortly afterward, President Trump announced a ceasefire in the conflict, which, for now, seems to be holding. This brief but intense incident prompted plenty of reconsideration of previous periods of tension between the United States and Iran, including one of the most embarrassing moments in the second presidential campaign of former Arizona Senator John McCain. Vulture writer Herschel Punja wrote about this. The whole thing started when McCain sang a parody of the Beach Boys song Barbara Ann. It was April 2007. And McCain was taking questions from voters in South Carolina.
He fielded a question from a member of the audience about Iran. And the attendee wanted to ask him, when will we send an airmail message to the real problem in the Middle East? McCain responds by launching into an impromptu song.
That old Beach Boys song, Bomberan. Bom, 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 bom. Anyway.
And it was a time when if you searched John McCain on YouTube, this was the number one hit, was him singing this parody song.
I think I remember seeing it maybe on The Daily Show or something like that. But my memory at the time is that the way it was portrayed by people who were commenting on it was John McCain is just kind of making up this song off the top of his head. But what I learned from your piece is that that's not what was happening.
Yeah, it is funny to think that everyone seemed to think that John McCain had sort of freestyled a Weird Al Yankovic song about violence in the Middle East, where as opposed to just being referencing an already existing thing. But yes, so that song has had a long lineage in American culture, starting in 1979 with the Iran hostage crisis. And for those who aren't familiar, basically what had happened was a group of students in Iran had stormed the embassy in Tehran, the American embassy, and they had taken 66 Americans captive. This was in response to America giving asylum to the recently deposed Shah, who had had a terrible human rights record in Iran. And so Iran asked for America to extradite the Shah so that they could face justice in Iran. And Americans weren't having any of it. They immediately started calling for military intervention in Iran. And eventually, it didn't take very long, actually, one of those calls to violence found its way into a parody song.
As I understand from your piece, there were several different versions of the song.
Yes, correct. So the first version was by a group called the Baritone Dwarves in Boston. There's a version by a group called the Scudsies. There's a version by a group called JC and the B1 Bombers.
Bum 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 aran. Bum 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 aran.
But the most popular version, the one that we all know, is by a group called Vince Vance and the Valiants.
Old Uncle Sam's getting pretty hot.
And it's not clear whether they're all just plagiarizing each other or like they all came to this idea originally. But I think it like the popularity of it speaks to sort of the anger in America at the time, right? This song became an outlet for those feelings. And it's also like maddeningly catchy, right? If you hear the song, like, it really burrows its way into your head and it launders these calls to violence through these repetitive doo-wop harmonies where like it's like a barbershop quartet is singing about bombing Iran, and like it really makes it start to feel like a really normal thing.
And the other thing that your piece points out is that before John McCain revived this parody song in 2007, it had actually resurfaced a couple times in the 1990s.
Yeah. So actually the song has sort of kind of traces the legacy of US-Iran relations over the last 40 years. Because when every time tensions become inflamed, people start singing the song again. And even during the Gulf War in the 90s, a bunch of people sang the song, but they changed the lyrics to be about bombing Iraq. And so like for example, Rush Limbaugh being one of them. So the song has kind of always sort of been around, kind of floating in the zeitgeist.
And we all know, obviously, that Senator McCain did not win the presidential election in 2008. How much does it seem like this early viral gaffe cost him? It was a big enough deal that it ended up coming up in two of the presidential debates that cycle between Senator McCain and Barack Obama.
John, you're absolutely right that presidents have to be prudent in what they say. But, you know, coming from you, who, you know, in the past have threatened extinction for North Korea and, you know, sung songs about bombing Iran, I don't know, you know, how credible that is.
I think coming out of a time when Americans were understandably frustrated with the wars in the Middle East not yielding results that they were looking for, I think that was a pretty tough hit on McCain's credibility. But I will say, like, Senator McCain never backed down from this comment. So he was once asked in an interview, like, if he was proud of having sung this song. And he said, listen, I was at a campaign event stop with veterans. And when I get together with other veterans, I joke around. And if you can't take a joke, you should just learn to lighten up.
Very John McCain.
It's also very like there's a direct line to the way people talk about these things now, too. You know what I mean?
Yes. Well, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the other thing that's really fascinating about your piece is that fast forwarding ahead to 2025, this song is still in the zeitgeist.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, as we're all familiar with now, Israel began a bombing campaign in Iran on June 12th. And very soon after that, a family in Israel was singing this song on a balcony, and like a mother, a father, and a young child.
Bomb, bomb, my brothers, when you're messing with the Jews, you're always going to lose its God's plan, and God rules the land.
That video immediately went very viral on the internet. And then like just a few days after that, after the US joined in on Israel's bombing campaign, Donald Trump actually posted a video on Truth Social of a bunch of warplanes ominously soaring through the sky. And then the soundtrack to that video was, of course, Bomb Iran.
So, Herschel, you mentioned a moment ago that the tone of Senator McCain's answer when he was asked about it many years later, basically, you know, either take the joke or shut up, is resonant for you in terms of political discourse these days. Tell me more about what you mean by that.
Yeah, I mean, I think politicians are always using quote-unquote humor to launder often very terrible rhetoric and very violent rhetoric. And then they always kind of say, I was kidding. I mean, this is a classic move from the Trump playbook.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking on a day when President Trump is in Florida to tour this detention facility that Florida has built to house migrants that the administration wants to deport. And he has branded this facility Alligator Alcatraz. I mean, it strikes me, I hadn't thought about this until you said that, that, you know, the idea of the original Alcatraz is that it was supposed to be one of the scariest prisons. And the idea of calling it Alligator Alcatraz, I guess you could argue that that's an intentional attempt to soften the reality of what is going to ostensibly happen at that facility.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like these little nicknames he gives things that are ostensibly meant to be humorous have that effect a lot of the times. And we buy into it because we say these things half ironically being like, oh, it is kind of funny, but like, it's not funny in the way he thinks it's funny. But then we are still repeating these things and then normalizing their usage in the discourse.
Boy, I have to say, Herschel, I did not expect that we were going to come into this conversation and talk about how it is possible that John McCain helped lay the groundwork for the success of President Trump's messaging, which is particularly ironic because famously there was so much rancor between the two of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what was it he said about John McCain? I like people who weren't captured.
That is what he said. And it seems like he thought it was funny when he said it.
But yeah, I think like it is interesting to see the direct through line between like the way politicians of that time would use humor and the way Donald Trump uses it now.
And they were serious. They were actually crocodiles. They were crocodiles from Africa. They are a step beyond. But no, that was really meant as a joke, but a lot of people liked it. And a lot of people think we should do it, frankly.
Well, Herschel Pundia is a staff writer at Vulture. Herschel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's great to be here.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
Our lives are not defined by any one action. Our lives are the sum of our choices.
That is a clip from the trailer for Mission Impossible Final Reckoning, the eighth installment in the series. Those films have grossed a combined $1.3 billion in the United States since 1996, easily one of the most successful Hollywood franchises of all time. But unlike other stratospherically successful franchises like Star Wars or the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the Mission Impossible movies are almost entirely defined by one actor, Tom Cruise. Yet somehow, Mission Impossible is hardly the defining achievement of Tom Cruise's film career, which is currently in its fifth decade. Cruise is practically the definition of the American movie star, and as I listen to Ving Rhames' narration in that trailer, when he says, "Our lives are not defined by any one action, our lives are the sum of our choices," I couldn't help thinking it was more than a teaser for the plot of the movie. Joining me now to talk about Cruise's legacy and the emerging question of whether we'll ever see anyone else like him is the show's pop culture expert, Amanda Kerberg. Amanda, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start by talking about this idea of Cruise as a movie star. What do you think defines Cruise as a movie star?
Cruise has this just completely ineffable charisma. He's known for this intensity, this insane drive that he just never takes a break, never relaxes. Every film that he's in, he is constantly trying to push the boundaries of what he did before. So you just know that when you see a Tom Cruise movie, you are going to be the recipient of that just gift of his intensity, of his energy. You know, this one film critic says Tom Cruise will break his leg to entertain you. Tom Cruise literally did his ankle in Mission Impossible Fallout. And because he got up and just kept walking, that shot is in the film. So he will, he has a physicality to him that is astonishing, that goes back to, you know, things that so many of the original movie stars in the Hollywood system were known for that you just can't get away with anymore. I mean, no one would let a contemporary Buster Keaton do those kinds of stunts. Nobody would let Donald O'Connor make him laugh again and spend 3 days in a hospital bed afterward.
Right.
But partially because Tom Cruise has been a producer for many decades now, he kind of can get away with some of that stuff, and he understands that his whole body goes into that star performance.
Yes, yes. And critically, I think that scene in that Mission Impossible movie where you see him on screen harm himself in the midst of doing a stunt, that's not even one of the most significant stunts that he does.
No.
That's not him, you know, free climbing a mountain or like a skyscraper, holding onto the side of a helicopter as it takes off.
Oh, it's wild. Yeah. And he understood really from the beginning that why he wanted to do those stunts was that it allowed the camera to be in places that it wouldn't otherwise if it was just a stunt double. And so that allows him to really take his performance into those spaces and make a more intimate connection than with the audience. But like that physicality goes into how he is a star off set as well. Like he's known as this incredibly generous person with fans, that he'll spend hours just working the rope lines. That's such a different thing than when we talk about the intimacy that stars provide today of like, oh, they might retweet you like this or reskeet you, whatever.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. You might get like an Instagram video of them putting their makeup on or something.
Yeah, it's like Tom Cruise will do a handshake. Tom Cruise will sit next to you and eat fistfuls of popcorn. If you catch a Cruise moment, it has an intense presence to it. Yeah.
Speaking of this idea of intimacy and commitment, I think we shouldn't also not forget that one of the things that really defines Cruise is that as well known as he is for these big action movies, he has also worked with auteur directors playing incredibly emotionally intense sort of Oscar caliber characters.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's been nominated for Oscars 4 times. And he started out, you know, he kind of hits it big in 1986 with Top Gun. And he's this young, just super, super desirable movie star and decides instead of just, you know, doing action or franchise movies, big blockbusters all the time, to seek out working with actors like Paul Newman, like Gene Hackman, Robert Duvall, Dustin Hoffman, directors like Coppola, Scorsese. I mean, just wanted to learn as much as he could. I think that is part of being a movie star, is having this kind of transcendent reverence for the industry. And we see that so much with Cruise. Just he loves movies. And that is also partly of what I think he's able to convey to the audience, of just there is something about a movie in theaters and making it that big and having, you know, a sense of the legacy of it across the century plus of Hollywood that he embodies.
I had this thought, you know, this idea of Tom Cruise being willing to break his leg to entertain you. The scene I always think about with Tom Cruise that will always make me have a lot of creative respect for him is Magnolia.
Mm.
Towards the end of that movie, when he has been resistant to go visit his dying father for years and years and years, and then he gets next to the bed and he says, "I'm not going to cry for you. I'm not going to give you that." And then he just starts wailing and saying, "Don't go away. Don't go away. I'm not going to cry." And of course, he is crying. It is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Tom Cruise will break his heart to entertain you.
Well, there you go. Yes, yes, yes. But I wonder if you feel like that commitment has something to do with the fact that, you know, I think the other thing that's core to Cruise's stardom is that he had a pretty significant fall from grace.
Yes.
Back in like 2005, was it?
He did. Yeah. It was 05, 06. Yeah. It's really interesting because, you know, he was known kind of coming on the scenes as a young star for these very Reagan, you know, excess, yuppie, confident roles, but he always brought a clear sense of his own mortality, of his fallibility to those roles. And so, like, that was built into, I guess, what his on-screen star persona was, even before he had to draw on that in his public persona. Because, yeah, by 2005, what's funny is, you know, in the trajectory of video killed the radio star, streaming almost killed the movie star when it comes to Cruz. And then AI, of course, is not killing the movie star, but will bring them back to life without their consent. But Cruz was, you know, one of the first viral moments of very early YouTube was him jumping on Oprah's couch.
Right.
And that hit in this kind of burgeoning digital culture moment as super cringy.
Right.
And that combined with, you know, everything else, the fallout from his breakup with Nicole Kidman, and those two had defined a kind of classic Hollywood power couple, was just this recentering of meaning, I think, in the film industry, in the star machine that didn't work well with Cruz. Cruz kind of got out more on shows talking about his own beliefs, talking about, you know, his experience with Scientology and his personal life, and people didn't like it.
Yeah.
And so I think he really had to figure out how to adapt to what audiences wanted now, how the industry was changing, you know, what Marvel had done, and this kind of, again, shift in what kinds of movies we go to see and who we go to see them for. I think that's maybe core to, like, what, when we say movie star and what Tom Cruise is as a movie star. When you go to see a Tom Cruise movie, you go to see a Tom Cruise movie. Yeah. You don't go to see a Marvel movie or a Jurassic Park movie or a James Bond movie. Like, it depends on where you put that emphasis. Is it the intellectual property? Is it the character? Or is it this just otherworldly human that you know will provide you this specific experience?
Ultimately, we just love to watch the guy.
We love it. Yeah. We love it. And I get it. Yeah.
Well, Amanda Kerberg is the show's pop culture expert. Amanda, thank you as always.
Thank you so much.
It is hot and dusty, and unless you are headed out of town this weekend, you are probably feeling pretty cranky. So, what better time to make trouble, rather to share true tales of bad behavior by some of our favorite local writers? This is our latest collection of soapbox essays, and we are starting today with a doozy from political consultant Stacey Pearson.
My dad was calling from a telephone number that will forever be etched in my brain. Not home, nor his work, but the landline of his favorite dive bar, and the location he could most commonly be found on a weekday morning. "Stace!" he screamed when I picked up. "I need Glenn to come pick up my lawnmower." "What?" I replied. In the background, a chorus of old men were laughing and yelling as The Price is Right blared. He screamed his demand louder that my husband pick up his lawnmower. "I can hear you," I screamed back. "I meant, why?" "I'm a get a goat," he said proudly. "Oh, geez, let's talk about this when I pick up the baby." He was yelling, "Joss loves goats," as I hung up on him. From 5 weeks old until my daughter Joss started preschool, my dad would meet me in the parking lot of my office. I'd transfer her from my car to his, and we'd carefully drive off to the tavern with her for breakfast. Bacon and eggs would be on the griddle, bar fruit in a highball glass for my child, breakfast beers or Bloody Marys on the bar for a group of regulars in their assigned seats. Characters included TT, the bearded, hammered mailman who would pick up his mail truck and drive straight to the tavern to start a shift. Pat, everybody's State Farm agent, whose office was conveniently located next door. Mike, the guy with gray hair who sold new TVs that never had boxes. And Crazy Connie, who won the lottery but lost the ticket, supposedly, and got stuck bartending in this West Side strip mall. My dad was still on the goat kick when I got to my folks' house that afternoon. His lawnmower was already in the garage. He glared at my BMW that I couldn't afford. "Oh, come on! We can't fit the lawnmower in that thing!" He waved his hand in disgust. "Has Ma heard about this plan yet?" He ignored the question and said, "We need Glenn's truck." Turns out we didn't need my husband's truck. The next day, with the strength of a nutty drunk man on a mission, my dad loaded up his lawnmower and drove it to our house himself. My poor husband was, until my dad walked in unannounced, sleeping off a graveyard patrol shift. I forgot to mention anything about lawnmowers, goats, or trucks in our previous day's download. "Your father just dropped off his lawnmower," my husband said with equal parts grogginess and irritation. "Oh, no. Did he have a goat with him?" "No." Did he have Joss? Yes. Our daughter thinks she's getting a baby goat. What is happening? In an unusual twist, my dad asked me to meet him at the tavern, not his house, that evening to get my kid back. The toddler and Papa were both pouting at the bar when I walked in. I hugged and kissed them and the entire cast of Old Spice-scented characters. Grammy's mean, Joss announced, making clear that my mother put an end to the farm animal in a suburban backyard fantasy. The drunk mailman was about to burst, holding in his laughter. Stays! It's a no-goat! Get it? No-goat! He yelled like he'd told the joke 200 times already. The Old Spicers roared. My dad, totally defeated, said, keep the lawnmower. It's old. I'll buy a new one at Sears.
That was Stacey Pearson of Phoenix. To hear more Soapbox essays and learn how you just might be able to tell your own story on the air, go to kjzz.org. And you are listening to the show. Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. When a well-known Phoenix restaurant announced earlier this month that it would be closing, Valley chef Adam Allison took to social media. His Facebook post about the closing of the Larder and the Delta read, in part, "If this isn't a sign of the times, Phoenix is the fifth largest city in the United States. This was one of the best meals and experiences I had all year. This shouldn't be the case. Make it make sense. If this doesn't wake you up to support your local chef-driven restaurants, I don't know what will." Allison has been in the restaurant business for more than two decades, has won the Food Network show Chopped, and is a private chef. After seeing his post, we wanted to talk to him more about what he thought about the state of the Valley's restaurant scene. So when he came by the studio, my co-host Mark Brody asked him how he sees it right now.
That's a good question because you could start in so many places and it's such a complex question. I think where you kind of see it now is kind of where you've seen it in the past 5 years, which it was on a trajectory to where it's going now, but I think COVID kind of really sped that up, which is, you know, people were kind of forced to be inside and they kind of lost the luxury of eating in restaurants. And so that kind of has stuck where, you know, a lot of people now are just really kind of eating and spending their money on convenience, whereas before it was more of the experience.
So it's less of like getting dressed up and going to a nice restaurant and more what can we take out or what can we have delivered to our house?
Yeah, I think the frequency of it has definitely changed. I still think people do go out dressed up and have nice dinners, but they don't do it like once a week like they used to, like happy hour on Fridays and nice dinner on Saturdays and maybe a dinner on Tuesdays somewhere in between. Now it's like once a birthday, you know?
It's almost kind of like for restaurants, what we've seen a lot with movie theaters, right? Like people just want to stream stuff on their couches. They don't necessarily want to go to a theater anymore.
Yeah, that's an example I use a lot. That kind of the music industry as well is that,
yeah,
you know, people are getting their music online. You don't really see that many bands happening because people can do it in their home. And movie theaters, like you can, why go out and spend a bunch of money when you could sit on your couch in your own home and use your own bathroom and eat your own food? And, you know, instead of what, the difference is what, just a bigger screen, you know? And so, yeah, with the restaurants, comparing that to that, it's, you know, people aren't really caring as much about like what it's going to look like when I sit down. Do I really want to spend 2 hours going out to dinner where I can just sit in my house and order up something online and have it delivered in my house in 20 minutes, you know? So people are choosing that over the latter.
What does that mean for this city?
You know, the thing about Arizona has always been an anomaly because it's so wide and spread out. Like you see a lot more chains here because they can put them in, you know, wherever they want. Like if you look at New York, you don't really see that many. It's a lot of mom and pop shops because everything is so condensed that you have your business right in your neighborhood. Where here, you need people to travel. So because of that, you can now order whatever you want and not have to go get it and have it brought to you. Or, you know, a lot of things are getting replaced with fast casual. And so I think, you know, if anything, it is moving towards that fast casual concept unless, you know, sitting that 2 hour dinner is kind of been a thing of the past.
I would imagine as a chef, that's probably not your favorite trend that you've ever seen.
No. Obviously, as a chef, when you want to get creative, you want to cook the food you want to cook, and you don't want to cook the food that is required to survive. Mm-hmm. And that's what a lot of chefs are doing, is they're changing the way they do things just to survive and not what they want to be cooking.
How so?
you know, so I'm in the process of opening a restaurant now, and we are looking at the menu and stuff, and we're looking at things that can be done as in a fast casual, things that can be done quickly, you know, slow food minus, you know, fast food. And it's, you're trying to figure out how to make that food that was considered slow food that takes a while to make it now fast and without losing any sort of quality in it. And that's a very hard thing to do.
Are people, are chefs still opening fine dining restaurants? Like, is there still any market for that here, do you think?
There are a couple good friends, a couple good friends of mine. Stephen Jones, whose restaurant, Lard and Delta, was fine dining, Course Fine Dining, recently closed.
Yeah.
And, you know, Corey Oppold has Course in Scottsdale, and that's been open a couple years. I think there's room for it, but there's not a room for a lot of them. You know, that's, it's, there's still people that want to go out and do it and have the budget to do it, you know, but I think a lot of people nowadays, they look at, you know, their money is not as good as it used to be. And so going out and spending $400 on a dinner may not be as easy as it was in the past. So they're kind of picking and choosing. Therefore, you can't have a plethora of restaurants open. You need the two good ones that survive will be the ones that kind of get that business.
Which is interesting because in the recent past, for example, like sort of after the worst of the Great Recession, the thinking was people maybe couldn't go on vacation or people couldn't buy a new car or something, but they could have a nice meal. So, you know, nice restaurants, the kind that you're describing, seem to be doing somewhat okay relatively. But now it sounds like what you're saying is even that is maybe too much for some people.
Yeah, I think there's just people are looking at different ways to kind of spend their money and what's important to them.
So what kind of food do you find that people want? You've talked a lot about fast casual, but I would imagine like people don't want not good food, right? They still want good food, just maybe cheaper and in a different environment.
Yeah. And it's funny you say the word good, because I think what people want is not great food. They want consistent, good food.
Mm.
And I think that's...
They want to know what they're getting.
They want to know what they're getting. That's why you see like people in lines at Cane's. It's like it's chicken tenders, but you know exactly what you're going to get every time. It's always the same thing. Like people don't want to risk going into a restaurant they've never had and dropping $200 and it being terrible and being like, you know, that was a waste of money. I could have just gone. And you always hear that on like line, like, I could have just gone down the street and gotten this for 50, you know what I mean? So yeah, I just think that's kind of what people are thinking.
Do you see this as a permanent trend?
Yeah, I do. I mean, unless the internet goes out, I think that it's definitely, you know, I think we saw something kind of switch in the 90s where everything was kind of like that proper restaurant, white tablecloths and wine glasses. Everything was proper. Then we're kind of like, no, like we can have wood tables and that like American bistro kind of aspect, have the food be quicker, do burgers and not have to be steaks all night, you know? And I think that kind of is where we are now, where we're kind of looking at that kind of concept is you may not even need a restaurant anymore. You know, like I get into the catering and private chefing because I don't have to support four walls. I just have to support myself, you know, and I think you'll see a lot more smaller restaurants, you know, with a bigger scale of the food being more accessible to people and being able to do all the delivery services and stuff like that, because you have to, because if you don't and you don't, you see the restaurants that don't do any of those, like they're losing out, you know, 30% revenue just because of that.
Which, as you have talked about before, like fine dining restaurants, it's not going to taste great if it's sitting in somebody's car being driven to your house, or even if it's in your car being taken to your house. Like that's the kind of food you kind of have to eat in the restaurant. It's got to be like fresh out of the kitchen.
Right. Yeah. And it's plated a certain way. So you can't really plate some of these beautiful dishes in a, you know,
in a clamshell,
in a styrofoam, right? Clamshell. Yeah, yeah. You know, it just doesn't work. That's why those type of restaurants, like you have to be in the right, it has to be like a perfect storm for you to be super successful.
So you don't see a time at some point down the road where maybe people will decide, you know, we've got a couple hours tonight. We've got maybe some disposable income. Let's go have a really nice meal. Like let's, you know, maybe do it like we did, you know, a few decades ago. And so it doesn't sound like you see that potentially coming back.
No, I see that. I don't ever see it really going away. I still think that people will go out to restaurants. They'll still be successful restaurants. I think it'll just be harder for restaurants, and I think there won't be as many successful restaurants.
Okay. So still some, like, fine dining places, but maybe not as many. And really only the good ones make it.
Yeah. And like I said, there's a perfect storm that has to exist for you to be successful. And, like, that's why those fine dining restaurants in Vegas, as long as they have the tourism, will be there because people go there to spend money, and that's just part of the trip. Maybe a mom and dad in Queen Creek isn't necessarily going to want to drop $500 to go out to dinner because they could just go down to the Queen Creek Olive Mill and get something for $20, you know? it's just kind of like where it's dependent on a lot of other things. But I do think, you know, even in Arizona, I think there's definitely room for those type of restaurants here. It's just that there's not, I don't think, a room for a lot of them.
That is Adam Allison, a chef and business owner here in the Valley. Adam, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
And finally, one last thing before we go. Yesterday, the Senate passed a bill that includes massive cuts to Medicaid. If it becomes law, this would be the biggest cut in the program's history. Hundreds of thousands of Arizonans could be impacted. But the politics of this can get in the way of the real impact on individuals. And so we want to know, how would you be affected by cuts to Medicaid? Send us an email at theshow@kjzz.org or leave a voicemail at 480-774-8299, and we'll be in touch. Thank you for listening to the show this morning. We'll be back tomorrow at 9. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.